To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello there, this is John Doe from the band X. You are listening to The Story Behind the Song on the Consequence Podcast Network, and I'm so glad you are.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Story Behind the Song, the Consequence Podcast Network series where we interview the iconic artists behind the most iconic songs of the past few decades. I'm your host, Peter Chatti, and each month I dive deep into conversations with your favorite musicians of all time to get insights into the creative journeys behind their most popular and lasting songs. I also ask each artist about one of their personal favorite deep cuts from their own catalog. And in the process, these living legends reveal frequently surprising, never-before-discussed details about these songs and their creative journeys, as well as candid reflections about their personal triumphs and challenges. In this episode, I speak with John Doe of X, a band that formed in 1977, released its first album in 1980, Los Angeles, and defined LA's punk scene with iconic songs that still rage over 40 years later. John is a multifaceted artist. He's a musician, songwriter, actor, and poet. We discuss the punk classic Los Angeles from the album of the same name, a provocative song that features a central character, a real-life central character, whose perspective is so raw and intolerant that some radio stations now refuse to play it. We also discuss John's pick, his bandmate Exene Cervenka's very different country-infused beautiful song Alone in Arizona from Doe's 2016 solo album, Westerner. So take a listen as we dive into The Story Behind the Song with John Doe of X. John, welcome.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And John, where are you today?
I'm in Austin, Texas, the north part of Austin.
Ah, outstanding. And when did you move to Austin?
It'll be 5 years in March.
Okay. Yeah. And before that, you lived in Los Angeles, right?
No, I haven't lived in Los Angeles for probably 30 years. In about 1989, I moved up to the Grapevine, Fraser Park, you know, just above Six Flags Magic Mountain, and lived there for about 20 years. Then my partner and I ended up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I lived in Bakersfield for a little while, then San Francisco, North Bay, and then in the East Bay, and then we moved out here.
Ah, great. Yep. Great. And how do you like it over there?
It's great. I mean, the summers are punishing, and they are brutal. But I grew up in Baltimore, so, you know, humidity doesn't scare me.
Yeah.
It's still terrible, but you know, you take a shower when you get sweaty, you know, and we have air conditioning and, you know, modern advances like that, but it's great. I mean, it is like every place changing quite a bit. You know, I'd like to throttle somebody at the New York Times talking about Austin is the place to move. And it's like, Jesus Christ, dude, really? And the housing costs have gone way up. I'm not sure that we could have actually bought a house in the market now, but I'm very fortunate to have a house, A, but B, to have gotten here when the prices were sort of reasonable.
Glad you said that about the New York Times, because I won't ask you about that now. Just as a fun fact, my mother-in-law and her new husband are in Austin, and they were just visiting, and so
yeah,
there is that connection. We have that conversation a lot.
Right, it's a great place. It's still good for music. It's a little bit of monoculture, even though there are some fringe, you know, hip hop and you know, different rock and roll bands and things like that, but it's very livable. And you know, they have this HAM, which is you know, medical insurance for you know, musicians that don't have coverage, and SIM, which is you know, for mental health, and you know, it's pretty music friendly. Although the two big rehearsal places just got bulldozed to make way for big apartment buildings, you know? So it's like, yeah, we love you, but you really can't rehearse here. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's a shame. Yeah. That's a shame, because those iconic spots are so important and such a part of music.
And that, you know, the kind of slacker culture really started here, because you could have a couple bands and you could 10 bar a couple of shifts and you could make your way, you know, you didn't have to work too hard.
Yeah.
But that's over.
So do you miss Los Angeles at all?
No, because it's changed so much, you know. I mean, when I moved out of LA in 89 it was already, you know, had sort of shifted under your feet, and that's the nature of LA. But I enjoy seeing people there. I enjoy, you know, going to certain places, but a lot of them are gone. So, yes and no. You know, I get to go back there to work, and that's cool.
Yeah. No, I gotcha. Well, listen, again, great to have you on, John. And today we're going to be talking about two songs. And as always, like I said, we talk about one of the most iconic songs of my guests. And we're going to be talking about Los Angeles, the great song Los Angeles from the album with the same name, which came out in 1980. And so we're going to dig deeply into that musical journey. And then the second song is a selection that you chose from your solo album, Westerner, from 2016. And the name of that song is Alone in Arizona. And we're going to dig deep in that song too, which is a very different kind of song, obviously,
yes,
than Los Angeles. And so it's a great juxtaposition. But first of all, before we dig into those songs, John, can you just kind of take me through your musical journey? You said you were born and raised, or at least raised in Baltimore, and how you picked up music and picked up, you know, guitar and singing and all of that, where that came to be, and then ultimately your journey from there.
Oh, gosh. Well, my parents played music. My dad played piano and my mom sang, but it was kind of long hair, you know, classical style music. So we had records, and a lot of it was opera, and I didn't get that. But growing up in the age that I did, late 50s, early 60s, folk music was what kids got. So I had some records of my own, some, you know, 10-inch records and LPs that were of Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston and people like that. So and a lot of those. And there was also a guy named Sam Hinton from San Diego. Who was more of a musicologist and a biology teacher, I believe. But he was very instrumental in my learning of the folk songbook, because he had a record called Singing Across America, and it had all these old folk songs, Frankie and Johnny and the Barnyard song, you know, I had a bird, the bird pleased me, that sort of stuff. But a lot of it was about, you know, the devil and drunkards and people dying. And it's like, and this was just considered, oh, this is kids' music, you know, let the kids listen to this. So I'm sure that that's where a lot of my storytelling in lyrics comes from. And then living in Baltimore in, you know, 62, 63 is when we moved there. And, you know, there were great radio stations and they were still playing Chuck Berry and doo-wop songs because Baltimore was a little behind the times. And then the British invasion happened and I was in fourth grade, I think, or something like that. It's like, holy crap, there's this. And then, you know, then soul music comes, you know, Motown comes behind that. And, you know, James Brown had his own station in Baltimore. He had several on the East Coast. But anyway, so I'm part of that generation and I don't like to brag about it, but it was pretty great because you could just turn on the radio and they would, you know, have pretty great songs. And top 40 was also pretty mixed. You know, they would have Dionne Warwick, and then they would have some like Johnny Tillotson that was sort of country and, you know, stuff like that. And then, you know, I was 14, 15 when psychedelic music started happening and I started playing bass. I figured that was easier than guitar. And some of that's borne out by like some of the guitar players' personalities that I know, because they have to sit in their bedroom and play those licks over and over until they get them right.
How did that happen? How did you pick up the bass and play that? Did somebody buy it for you? Did you go out there because you knew that you just wanted to try it?
Well, as usual, I had a friend who played piano. And like I said, I wasn't interested in guitar. So I thought, oh, bass seems a little easier. It's only got four strings. And I bought one. It was a Kent. It was $125 and I paid like $5 a week. And then my second bass, which I still have and wrote most of the early X songs on, was a 1960 jazz bass, and they're pretty rare. And another friend who was a guitar player had bought it at a pawn shop for $150 and I bought it from him. And now it's worth, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
I bet it is.
Well, partly because I own it, but also because of the just it's a rare instrument for Fender. But so psychedelic music, The Doors and Jimi Hendrix, and I got to see them live and Janis Joplin and Cream and people like that, and it was blew my mind, you know. I mean, I was
so you were pretty deep into music already. If you're going to see shows like that at the ages of 15, 16.
Well, I know, you know, it's a point of pride, I guess. The very first rock and roll show I saw was the Rolling Stones.
When they
were touring the big hits, High Tide, Green Grass. So 66 or something like that. Mm. And it was at at the hockey arena or basketball arena. And I think they played about a half an hour because people climbed on stage and the cops threw them off and then the show was over. And I thought, what have I, you know, I had no idea what I had just seen, but it was cool.
Yeah, no, I bet it was. And you were still in Baltimore at the time?
Yes.
And so then what took you, or when did you go out west from Baltimore?
I left at the end of 76 and I've been playing in, you know, cover bands and bar bands and things like that, you know, probably for 5 years. Four or five years. pretty regularly. And there were a couple of places we played in Fells Point, and that was John Waters and his crew's hangout. So I got to know John through there, and we go to, you know, Edie's Shopping Basket, which was her thrift store, you know, Edith Matthews thrift store. And, you know, they were kind of attainable, you know, movie stars. They were movie stars, but they would just be hanging out at the bar and you could talk to them. And, you know, met Divine a few times and he was, you know, like everyone says, just sweet and kind and, you know, not at all like his stage character. But I had to get, I knew I had to get out of there because my parents lived in New York. I had been to see Talking Heads and the Heartbreakers at CBGB's and Max's Kansas City. And it seemed as though New York was very kind of locked down, and it already, you know, there were a lot going on, and I was just done with the East Coast. I didn't like the weather and pretty, you know, cynical and negative kind of point of view, and went to the West Coast, and it was like, this is such a breath of fresh air. So
is that when you first moved out to the West Coast, was that when you first started writing music, or were you writing beforehand, writing your poetry beforehand?
No, I went to Antioch College. There was a branch in Baltimore, which were, they're all night classes, but they had a writing program. And I'm still in touch with a couple of people from that. I restarted going to a poetry workshop on Zoom with them once a month.
Ah, that's cool.
So yeah, I've been writing for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. I went to school for a year and then dropped out and then went back and worked. Part of Antioch is you have to work while you're in school. You have to make, you know, academic credits and also work credits, which I think is a great idea. But anyway, I was already writing kind of bad songs, writing songs that were trying to be like the band or Bob Dylan or something, you know, the Beatles or, you know, David Bowie. I don't know, you know, just stuff that was copying things.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I met Exene and had decided that, okay, that was then, this is now, you know, reinvent yourself. I sort of chose the, you know, stage name John Doe, you know, inspired by John Waters and Andy Warhol.
Well, that's interesting. So you were tired of the East Coast. You moved out to Los Angeles in 76, I think you said.
Yeah.
Okay. You moved out in 76. And where did you end up? What part of Los Angeles? Because Los Angeles has so many different personalities. In Venice.
Moved to Venice.
And then how soon thereafter did you meet Exene?
Pretty soon, because I went to the Venice Poetry Workshop, which is a fairly famous workshop. And I figured I could meet like-minded, you know, people. And Exene was there, and she was the only like other kind of young person who looked exotic and cool. And so I sat next to her. And we went out like right afterward, went to the bar next door, which was a kind of a jazz club called the Comeback Inn.
Oh, yeah.
It was, I mean, at that point you could, you know, live and be free in Venice, California.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I rented a house with my friend, and it was like $600, and it was a complete house. And then he left, he went back to Baltimore, and then I rented my own apartment, and it was like $125 or something. It was great. It was very bohemian then.
Yeah, no, there's no question.
Fond memories of it.
Yeah, I bet. And you had already had you already formed a band of some kind before meeting her?
It was pretty much the same time. I put an ad in this free paper called The Recycler. Well, it wasn't free, it was a classified paper. And Billy Zoom put an ad in the same day or the same week. And we called each other, you know, I guess the ads were similarly worded. And I was already playing with Billy, and we were just kind of feeling each other out and playing some old songs like, Bring It On Home to Me and Honey Don't and things like that. And he would sing a couple songs. There was another guy who ended up, Steve Allen, who ended up in 2020. We played with him for a little while. And then, you know, Exene was writing lyrics, and I thought there was she showed me the lyrics to I'm Coming Over. And I said, well, I could make this a song, you know? And then I asked her if I could play it in my band. And she said, absolutely not. This is my song. This is one thing of value that I have, and I'll be damned if you're going to, you know, take it from me. So I said, hey, Billy, you know, I think I have a good idea. Let's have this other person in the band. And he was skeptical at first, but realized that it was going to take a while for Exene to, you know, learn how to be well, she was a natural front person, but it was going to be a while for us to develop our sound. And it was going to take probably the same amount of time for people to start understanding what, you know, punk rock was. And I don't think they ever really did.
Well, so from the music that you were describing that you were into, and maybe I misunderstood it, but even with Billy, and you were playing some songs before you met Exene, and how did you evolve into this initial sound that became X, and then we'll delve into Los Angeles too.
I think it was keeping your ear open and influences of, you know, Iggy and the Stooges and David Bowie and even Roxy Music and certainly Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground and just what was happening in the world, you know, listening to the Ramones and listening to the Clash and you know, all the bands that were in LA as well. And it was, you know, so you kind of had a, you know, what's my version of this? Because certainly at that point, punk rock was very diverse and each city seemed to have its own sound, even though those were very diverse. You know, I think the New York scene was the most influential on us or on me. And, you know, the Ramones or Talking Heads or Blondie or Television. I mean, they're all very different. And the same goes for the bands in San Francisco, like the Avengers and the Dicks and or Off, Crime, the Nuns, people like that. They were all very different from each other. So it was like, how do I fit into this?
Well, what was the punk scene like in Los Angeles at the time? And was the punk scene in Venice as part of that?
No, it was in Hollywood. I mean, it was wide open because nobody could make any money at it. And, you know, the Mask was the main place that we played. Brendan Mullen, who ran that, also would rent some halls, you know, like social halls, and someone would wreck the toilet and then that would be over. So it was,
of course they did.
Yes, of course they did. Youthful anger, youthful whatever, stupidity. It was small. I mean, you know, maybe there were 150 people and most of them were in bands, and there was luckily I got to experience it, and for a long time the Whiskey A Go Go and the Starwood, which are the two big clubs there, in 76 and early 77, they had disco and they had cover bands, and they didn't really have, you know, they had slipped off of the, developing bands that are national bands that are touring. You know, they had sort of stopped doing that. And then by maybe the middle to the end of 77, they started doing, you know, having more, you know, they had Television and Blondie and Tom Petty and people like that.
Where was the club Mask?
It was right on off of Hollywood Boulevard.
Okay, it was.
Yeah. Cherokee, and it was an alley behind the Pussycat Theater, which was the, you know, dirty movie theater there. It was just a basement that Brendan found, and it was a total fire trap. There was one way in and one way out. I mean, luckily I got other people and my partner and friend twisted my arm to work on those two books, the Under the Big Black Sun and More Fun in the New World. And it chronicles that era from 77 to 82 and then 82 to 87.
Yeah. So, yeah. Gotcha. And okay. So you were, Exene was writing some poetry. She joined the band. You started to play together. When did you come up with the name X for the band?
That was Exene's idea. That was Exene's idea. Because most people were like the somethings, you know, mm-hmm. the Ramones, the Talking Heads, or I don't know, maybe it was. But so she said, if I had a band, I would just put a big black X up there. And I thought, cool.
It worked.
It's an original name. It was really difficult for us to get paid on Spotify for a while.
I bet.
Yeah. But yeah, it conjures all these things of, you know, a cross tilted on its side or a sign at the name of the X or, you know, X is an unknown quantity and all these sorts of things. So it was more than just one meaning. And you could see, you know, X's everywhere, you know, just in nature, in the city. And yeah, everybody kind of realized how original it was.
No, really interesting. And thanks for taking us through that guided tour of your early days and getting you into your musical life. And we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to get into the story behind the song, the great song, Los Angeles. With that backdrop of Los Angeles that you just gave us. So we'll be right back with John Doe.
Hey there, it's Kyle Meredith from Kyle Meredith With. After you check out the latest episode of my show, be sure to check out some of our other great programs on the Consequence Podcast Network, including Standing BTS, a bi-weekly podcast covering all things BTS and ARMY, and The Opus, Consequence's original documentary podcast exploring legendary albums and their lasting legacies. So head to consequence.net to listen to these podcasts and many great others.
Okay, everyone, we are back. That was a quick break, and we are back with John to now get in deep into the story behind Los Angeles, which obviously the title track from the album of the same name that came out in 1980. And the band had started in 77, I think that was when you were officially formed and you were playing before then. So tell us about the making of Los Angeles and then getting into the song, just everything that you can recall going into that and how it came to be.
Well, Los Angeles got a bad rap from the other punk rock communities because Los Angeles, especially at that point, had a very glitzy, airheaded public image. But they didn't take into account that there were these writers like Nathaniel West or Charles Bukowski or, you know, all the John Fante. You know, all the beats kind of started in Venice. And so there's Los Angeles can be pretty cruel because you could live there cheaply. And there was a great bohemian kind of community that was going on. But everybody thought that as soon as you lived in Los Angeles, you didn't have anything to complain about. You know, you were given a Mercedes and a swimming pool and you were, you know, mom and dad paid for everything. And it was like, no. So that was part of writing the song, part of calling the record Los Angeles, was to put a stake in the ground. And it wasn't called L.A. because, you know, E-L-L-A-Y was the way people would, you know, put it down. So Los Angeles was older. Los Angeles was, you know, the Angels. Los Angeles had more music, just the words. And it was a way for us to stand up for our community, you know, for our punk rock world. And I think at that point, you know, I was reading a lot of Charles Bukowski because, you know, he makes writing seem attainable, even though it's like John Steinbeck or you know, Ernest Hemingway. There, it's very simple, but it's really well crafted and deep. And it also was shocking, you know, and that's what Andy Warhol and John Waters kind of taught us, is that, you know, everyone, things have become very complacent. And so it was easy to be shocking, whether you're like the Cockettes up in San Francisco or, you know, John Waters and Divine, in Baltimore. It's a way of getting noticed. And, you know, I mean, it was the same thing, I think, with Vivian Westwood having swastikas on clothing. It's like, look at this and don't just have it in the history books. And what do you think? Think. That's it.
Yeah.
And I still wish that people would think a little deeper about everything.
So it was,
but So in the song, I think lyrically it was to be shocking. It was based on a friend of ours, a character who had gotten fed up with the whole scene and moved to London. And the simplicity of the words were directly influenced by Charles Bukowski and some other, you know, poets of the time, you know, maybe and also influenced by the poets I knew in Baltimore, which were performance oriented. I don't know.
Did they naturally flow? Did the lyrics just naturally flow?
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. I have a book, a little, you know, book like this, that's got the words in it, you know, just kind of written down verbatim.
That's great.
Yeah. It's nice that I could find that it's not lost somewhere. Yeah,
that's a great little treasure.
Yes. I, you know, I'm not a hoarder, but I do, you know, keep some ephemera of the different times. So, I mean, at the time it was controversial, you know, using the N word and everything. And it was meant to be, it was like, you have to examine how people become racist. That was the point of it. And since punk rock was, if you wanted to suffer, you know, the abuse that punk rockers got, you know, if you were, you know, whatever color you were or sexual persuasion, it's like, you're welcome, because you're going to get more shit. but you know, we're inclusive. Come on in, you know.
Right.
Even though it was, you know, primarily white, but there were a lot of, you know, gay influences that were all accepted, and especially in the early days, you know, as the 80s wore on, it became a little bit more, it was a little different. But yeah, it was meant to be controversial. It was meant to hold up a mirror to people, like, here's this, you know, N-word, Jew, Mexican, what are you going to do? So that was the point of it. And surprisingly, up until I think recently, that it was played on KROQ, you know, it was played on, you know, a big FM station with the N-word in there. And it's like, okay. Obviously now we don't. When we sing it live, it's Christian and Jew. We changed it to, she started to hate every Christian and Jew.
So it's like, you know, it's
equal,
you know,
hate for everyone.
I was gonna ask you about that. I was gonna ask you about just the evolution of the N-word, and it was meant to shock. You included it to shock when you wrote that song, because that's kind of what, you know, to get people to think, like you said. And so, you know, obviously that song, I spent my formative years in Los Angeles too, heard that song all the time on K-Rock and all the other mainstays when it came to music. And how do you feel about that, of the word, which was intentionally there to shock, now being altered or changed for understandable reasons, but nonetheless, as an artist who was there meant to shock, how do you feel about that?
I think you have to change with the times and new information. And I mean, it was meant to shock, but I don't think we understood how hurtful it basically is. So you don't realize things, you know, you don't realize, and you have to change.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, and I certainly didn't want to, you don't want to dig your heels into the wrong side of an argument. Even though I, you know, there's part of me that believes that artistry and the arts is a safe place. And, you know, Robert Mapplethorpe and his photographs and, you know, all the books that get banned and crap like that. It should be a safe place, but I'm interested in communicating to people, entertaining people. I'm not interested in getting canceled because I you know, want to be a hard ass about artistic expression.
Yeah.
It's there. No. It's there. Yeah. I'm glad we haven't gotten canceled because of it. Cause that was not the intention of it.
Well, you guys are, listen, X, your band plays such a central role in music and your albums, a couple of them, you know, for not that it necessarily matters to get accolades, but Rolling Stone, I list them as in the top several hundred of all time, like 500 of all time. Mm-hmm. And so pivotal role in music. And it is an interesting dilemma for an artist. Yeah. It just is, because the times are different than they were. And like you said, the intention was meant to be a certain way, but it's understandable what the evolution is, but it's still an interesting subject to cover for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that the people are more aware of all those things, you know, whether it's the, you know, Washington Redskins and, or whether it's just the way people act at a business meeting.
Yeah.
You know, so they're more aware. Maybe they're faking it, but I think that they have to be more aware to be equal, to listen to, you know, and that's all good. You know, we stood for being, you know, inclusive and, but you have to grow. And
yeah.
The language is always changing. English is always kind of evolving and, you know, for better or for worse. And so, yeah, I'm in. I want to be on the right side. I want to help people and not hurt people.
Understood. Yeah. And how did the, let's go into more into the music of the song itself. So lyrically, understand where that came from, but tell us a little bit about what did the lyrics come first? Did the music come first? The riffs? How did that all come to be?
At that time, and even now, I'll have a number of different pieces of writing. Some are Xane's, some are mine, and different pieces of music, and just sort of mix and match until it seems like the meter. And or sometimes, you know, Xane's very talented in being able to write a song beginning to end. I mean, she'll write a verse, a chorus, a verse, you know, and then there'll be a space for another chorus, and then you're done. And, you know, The New World was kind of like that. But for Los Angeles, I started finding a way to have three chords in a loop, where normally it would be four. A normal kind of chord progression, you would have equal measures for four chords. And on Los Angeles, it started out being four, but then it became more minimal and was just three chords, and they would sort of go around in a circle. So, you know, and then there wasn't really a chorus. I mean, the chorus is at the very beginning, where she had to leave Los Angeles and you know, just again, telling a story of someone who was fed up and getting out. And I think there was a propulsion to the music, which was part of our thing. And Ray Manzarek encouraged or asked us to try doing the opening, opening four chords twice. So that's a great opening. Okay. Try doing it twice. And I still use that technique.
Yeah. How about that? And so for everybody out there, Ray Manzarek from The Doors.
Yes.
And how did you end up working with him on this album?
He saw us at the Whiskey. And actually his wife, Dorothy, had to tell him, oh, they're playing your song, Soul Kitchen. We were already playing Soul Kitchen. Yeah. And he goes, really? What? Because we played it so much faster. It sounded nothing like The Doors. And we met him afterward, and he said, I'd like to come to a rehearsal. He had read an article in the LA Reader that I think Chris Morris wrote. And he was, you know, he saw a lot of similarities between the scene that the Doors were in the early days and the punk rock scene, like community and that sort of thing. So
pretty interesting, because certainly the sound obviously is quite a bit different than the Doors, yeah. But the themes are not.
Right.
Very LA, very Los Angeles.
Dark underbelly. And you know, we were lucky to capture that. I think there's some other bands that have followed in those footsteps, you know, certainly NWA or Jane's Addiction, you know, can kind of pinpoint an era. And yeah, we're lucky. We had our ears open. I don't know. We know we had a lot of help from all the other bands that we were influenced by, whether it was Fear or the Weirdos or even the Germs. We just all influenced each other. And I wish I had a better description of how that music came, but you know, normally I would just keep playing and find something and then keep refining that and keep playing. And then as the words and music are, I did most of that song, both words and music. Exene did some editing, I think, in the words. But it's just sort of piecing it together. You know, it's you may have the first two or three lines and then shit, what do I do now?
And did you know that, did it feel to you that one was special?
Yes. And same with The World's a Mess. The first time you rehearse some things and it all kind of fits together. It's not difficult. People intuitively know what to play. And then you think, oh, well, I did a good job in, you know, giving the skeleton so that people could just make it whole. I don't think we had any idea that it would be as long lasting. You know, we played at the Terragram, the beginning of December, and people were singing singing that song, like all the words, not just the Los Angeles part, so loud that Exene and I could hardly hear ourselves. You know, there were 50, 75 people up front that were singing at the top of their lungs, and I got all choked up. I lost my place. I ended at the wrong time. I got all choked up because I realized that it had meant so much to so many people over the years. And this, it was a really young audience, you know, a lot of people in their 20s and 30s and stuff like that. And I was like, shit, that's what you hope for is that, as an artist, you hope that people, that you say something that people can relate to and they get something out of and they identify with or whatever.
No, it's got to be gratifying 40 years later after writing that song.
Yeah.
To have it be such a part of the consciousness still today. Because it is.
For a small group, but I'll take it.
Well, I don't know. It is such an iconic song.
Well,
it is. It's just part of the pantheon now. And so
like I say, in a limited group, and I think that's kind of better than you know, trying to appeal to every like jock and sorority person. God bless them. You know, but they're not my people. There's not much of the Venn diagram that's overlapping on that, you know.
Yeah. So one more question about it before we move on. We'll take a break and then get into the second song. But how would you say that Ray Manzarek influenced your sound in that first album?
By what he didn't do. He, you know, at that point we had been playing pretty regularly for 3 years. And 79, we were, you know, headlining the Whiskey and playing two shows a night. And, you know, we were fully developed. So some producers feel like they have to put their stamp on a production. others just sit back and get good performances. And that's what the Doors were all about. So Ray was taking his experience and applying it to us, you know, getting good sounds, inspiring us to do the best we could. And I mean, I think we had $10,000, and we recorded the record in 10 days. I mean, you know, maybe it was 5 days for tracking and 5 days for mixing or something like that. It was,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure it was under 2 weeks. But if you know what you're going to do and you have a little room for improvisation or melodic changes, I mean, I still try to do that. You should be able to make a record in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, that is such a part of the punk ethos too. Not necessarily just punk, but yeah, the authenticity of really getting the performance, bringing that into the recording itself. So you feel like you're part of that, you know, you're part of it.
Yes. It should feel alive. It should feel like something is happening as it's being recorded. Not that it's been
right,
all scripted and manicured, you know. I think that's what punk rock was getting away from. You know, we owe a great debt to people like, you know, Fleetwood Mac and Boston and Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles and things like that, because everything was so manicured. And we just thought, well, what the hell? Where's Louie here? Just where's three chords in the truth? Or is it two chords in the truth? I think it's two chords in the truth is what he got.
Yeah, maybe. No, that's great. So listen, we're going to take a quick break, another break, and then we're going to be right back with John Doe. And we're going to talk about the second song, Alone in Arizona.
All right.
And we're back, John.
Yes.
Thanks again for being here. Now we're going to talk about your song selection, because it was wide open.
Yes.
So the question for me to you was, pick a song, any song that was in your discography. And you chose the song Alone in Arizona from your 2016 solo album, Westerner. And this is a very different, beautiful song. Why did you choose this amongst all the others that you could have chosen from?
I don't know.
<It's>, okay.
Seemed like a good idea. Well,
that's punk. That's very punk.
Well, because it was very different and it was somewhat newer, those are two main things. But it also, Exene wrote this song. She wrote the song beginning to end, and it was on her solo record called, oh crap, I can't remember the name of the record. The something of excitement. Anyway, you could look it up. You could plug it in there. But I love the song, and she did it with these two, she recorded it with these two jazz guys, Brady Blade and Christian McBride. And a friend of ours, Michael Blake, had just passed away. He's a author. He wrote Dances with Wolves, and he was a great friend of ours. And I record, so I wrote several songs that were tributes to him or about him, or, you know, some fictional stuff of him as the character, and kind of the Westerner is alluding to him, because he, to me, represented, you know, what that was like. And so I recorded it in Arizona, in Tucson, and Hal Gelb from Giant Sand kind of represents the Tucson sound, which has this deep reverb and a lot of psychedelic kind of effects to it. And you can, it has a lot of space, like the desert. And it had a lot to do with our history, you know, from the Hungry Wolf and Michael's, you know, Dances with Wolves and his honoring of wolves and that. And so it's like a lot of songs. It goes pretty far back. It doesn't just happen. It may happen at a certain time. And I'm not even sure that Exene wrote that about Michael. So But for me, it represented that.
Interesting. And you mentioned the Tucson sound.
Yeah.
Is that a thing that is there?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, people like, Hal was instrumental in kind of developing that. Other bands you might know, Nico Case, mm-hmm. her sound was very influenced by living in Tucson. Mm. Calexico is another band from there. The Friends of Dean Martinez, which is kind of instrumental. Yeah.
Interesting.
I would say it probably started in the early 90s, something like that.
So you have a song like that is so different from at least early X, right? Mm-hmm. So fundamentally different. Do you just take on different personas when you play different shows? X has your great catalog of songs that you're going to play and the punk sound. I can't imagine, but forgive me for maybe not having a broad enough imagination, but for bringing some of these other songs into your shows today, do you do that?
Oh, sure. Or not into X shows.
No, not into X shows, right.
We just play X songs and X shows. But I mean, most musicians love different, all different kinds of music, mm-hmm. and are capable of playing different styles. And I realized some point, maybe in the mid 80s, that I could sing and play country Western music and it's convincing and it sounds decent. It sounds real. And if there's anything, I'm kind of I do have a persona, but it's not like a David Bowie reinventing, it's all based in Americana. It's all based in stories. It's all based in characters. It's based in being real and being authentic, not trying to pretend. I'm an unpretender. Yeah.
Well, you're a storyteller, right? Because it's reflected by all the different things you've done. You're a poet. You're a songwriter. You're a singer. You're an actor. You've been in a variety of shows. I think Roswell was one of them.
Yep.
And so you've worn many different hats, but you're storytelling throughout all of this.
Yes. And if you're given an opportunity to do something as an artist, then I think it's your job to see if you can, to step outside your comfort zone, to test yourself, to, see if you can do it, not to expand rather than to contract. And it's like, okay, I may fall flat on my face, but I'm going to give it a try.
So what excites you now?
Well,
what are you focused on?
I made a new record, a new solo record that's going to be out in 2022. And this is more of a concept record than I've ever done. It's called Fables in a Foreign Land, and everything takes place in like 1890. It's all pre-industrial. There's no modern things. And it's I'm calling it a folk record, the John Doe Folk Trio. And it's just upright bass and drums and acoustic guitar and, one or two guys singing. And it was born out of having nothing to do during quarantine. And yeah. And I was really fortunate to work with two guys in Austin that are, one, Kevin Smith plays with Willie Nelson and Conrad Chacroon plays with Patty Griffin. So they're, it's great.
Great artist.
Yeah. And I have two horses and I ride horses all the time.
That doesn't sound bad.
No, I'm incredibly grateful and fortunate. I don't have a million bucks in the bank, but that's okay. I'm good. And I'm still really happy when X can play. We just did this holiday run and unfortunately had to cancel the last show in San Diego because
Yeah, I know. Right down the street from me, by the way. The Belly Up's a great club.
Yeah,
great club.
We love playing there. But a couple of our party got COVID, even though we're all vaxxed and boosted and everything like that. So that sucked.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet it did. Hopefully you're going to be able to reschedule that for early this coming year.
I think we might do it in May because we have another show that we're doing something for Tony Hawk in May. So
okay,
just do a one-off. But
well, when is your new album, your solo album, going to be coming out in 2022?
There's pre-order at the beginning of May. I think May 8th or something like that. So we'll be releasing a video and taking pre-orders, and then I think the vinyl will be delivered in May. So March. And then there's another kind of single video due in April, and then a third one in May and then we'll do some touring behind that.
So before we close, are there any artists right now, any new or emerging artists that you feel that speak to you or feel are breaking new ground that you just...
Absolutely.
Who do you think of?
Well, there's one woman who I think is still in LA named Sunny War. And she's kind of a folk singer.
Sunny War.
Yeah. I don't think that's her real name, but that's what she goes by. And also Skating Polly, who we've played with several times. Exene produced a record of theirs years ago when the two sisters, they're I think half sisters, but they were like 8 or 9 and 12. And they're like, now they're 21 and 24 or something like that. And they've been a band for 10 years and they have like 5 or 6 records.
That's amazing.
They're so
that's
good.
Amazing.
They're so good. There's also a guy in San Francisco named Trey Burt, who's also a folk singer. He's getting a lot of good notice. Yeah. But one of my favorite records of 2021, or maybe it was 2020, was the Psychedelic Furs. They put a new record out, same as us. So their record was so good, called Made of Rain. And then, of course, Fiona Apple's record, which came out that year, was one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, no, it's a great album. It's always fun to ask musicians who inspire them or who they believe are breaking new ground. And it's also wonderful to hear that, you know, obviously folk has such a long history, but breaking new ground or telling new stories, it's just, you know, bringing a fresh take to it. And you mentioned Patty Griffin, and what an amazing artist.
Oh, there's another record I heard recently by a woman named Maddie Diaz, M-A-D-I Diaz. Beautiful record.
I'm going to check all these out.
Oh, good.
That's why I'm writing them.
I hope your listeners will give a listen to them too.
Well, I'm sure that they will. And they should definitely check out X's last album too. That just the first new album in 35 years from the original band, from the original lineup, called Alphabet Land. And that came out in 2020. And then you have your upcoming new album coming out. You're touring. The tour was cut short in December, but you're going to be coming back in the early part of the year, which will be great. And I'll be at that show down at the Belly Up for sure. And I always close up with this question.
Yes.
If you didn't become an artist and make that your calling, what do you think you would have done?
Oh, God. I've been asked this a few times. I have no idea. But I would like to think I would be a naturalist of some sort, you know, someone who a forest service or something like that. Yeah.
You love the great outdoors.
The great outdoors is your friend, because that's where you're more a human. That's where you can actually feel like a human rather than inside somewhere.
Yeah, which is such an important lesson these days when everybody's so digital.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It's an addiction, isn't it?
Yeah. And sometimes you got to just, you know, now I'll wax philosophical. And sometimes you have to get your head up away from the mobile phone, get out there, listen to some good music while you're doing it.
Sure.
walk the dogs, whatever it may be.
Yeah, walk the dog, but don't look at your phone while you're walking the fucking dog.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good
my partner
point.
Likes to say that person needs a dog app because they're completely oblivious of their connection to the dog or the outside, and they're looking at their damn phone, and the dog could be walking into traffic as far as they know. Enjoy the dog, for God's sakes. You're out with your dog.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, John, listen, really enjoyed it. Thanks for joining the story behind the song and getting deep into the two songs that we discussed today. Everybody should check out not only the musicians that John mentioned, but obviously the latest work that X has done. And then the upcoming tour coming out and the solo album that's going to be coming out too. But what a wonderful legacy, John. Great to hear the stories behind that. And thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. It's like easy and fun. And what else do you need? Right.
Right. That's the way it should be, right?
In theory, yes.
Very good.
Yeah, thanks, Peter.
That was John Doe of X, sharing his in-depth story behind his iconic punk ode to the City of Angels, Los Angeles, and his beautiful recording of Exene Cervenka's song, Alone in Arizona. I'm your host, Peter Chotti. You can follow me on Twitter at pchotti and at deepcutsmedia.com. For more of the story behind the song, make sure you like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and tune in on the third Monday of every month for new episodes. Also, make sure you're following the Consequence Podcast Network to keep up to date with all our series at consequence.net/consequence-podcast-network. As always, thanks for listening to the story behind the song.